everyone, and welcome again to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast brought to you by Shochamworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shochamworks and the Ecosystemic Futures series. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for resilient futures. In this series, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and the impacts they'll have on our future. And over the next three episodes, we're going to be diving deep into the deployment of generative AI, its vast implications and limits, along with the societal implications and how we can collectively design for ecosystemic resilience and better outcomes for humanity. My co-host today is James Villarubia. James is a White House Presidential Innovation Fellow and Digital Strategist for NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Welcome, James.
Thank you so much, Diane. And for our audience, as you just mentioned, I'm currently embedded in NASA, where I help them use AI in new and interesting ways. And that's sort of building on my almost two decades of experience in social impact startups and government, sort of deploying new technology solutions. So I'm really happy to join you and our guest today. So thank you for having me.
Fantastic. And super excited to welcome our guest today. So joining us today is Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Welcome, Pascal.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane. And James, very much looking forward to the conversation.
Excellent. We are as well. We have a real treat for the audience today. So let's dive in. So let's focus first on some of the highlights of your amazing journey, Pascal. How have these moments throughout your journey, your origin story, informed and inspired you about the path forward? And maybe share with us a little glimpse of your vision for the best possible future, one where we've designed for ecosystemic resilience, and what role does artificial intelligence have to play in that future?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me start out with, if you hear a tinge of an accent, I was born in Germany. That's where it comes from. I was very lucky and fortunate to stumble into some of the most interesting organizations of their times in their most formative years throughout my career. So as part of the team which built eBay across Europe, I was part of the team which built Mozilla and the Firefox web browser, this incredible open source movement, as well as spent some time at Google and then started my own companies. And about 10-ish years ago, I stumbled once yet again into the founding of Singularity University, which is a really fascinating think tank, which at the time was based on, and this might be a nice connection here, the NASA Ames campus in Mountain View, California. And what we did there was really imagining what a future could look like based on these exponentially accelerating technologies. So anything from blockchain and crypto and genetic engineering and space tech and, of course, artificial intelligence. And about 5 years ago, I left this place to once again branch out on my own, created what is now called Be Radical, which is an organization helping leaders and their organizations better prepare themselves for the future and deal with innovation and disruption, hopefully a little bit better than they did before they worked with us. Now, that all being said, I do think AI is at this interesting pivotal moment, and I do believe we can all feel this. I really just need to utter the words ChatGPT and everybody will probably nod and say, oh my God, yes, the world has changed in what really feels weeks, but in reality is, of course, month. And back in the day, we measured time in years and decades. So AI isn't new. AI has been around for a long time. We've made really interesting progress in the last 7-8 years, maybe. I guess ever since IBM destroyed the game Jeopardy for everybody. And before that, of course, we destroyed the game of chess, and then we destroyed the game of Go. But that's a really particular, interesting, very niche use case of AI, which is somewhat easy to train. And what we're seeing now with generative AI, so large language models or the image AI we're seeing, is that we can use it in much more broader and much more creative ways. And I think that leads us to, what can we actually do with it for the future? And I do believe that what AI becomes is, hopefully, a trusted co-pilot as we are navigating some of these really hard problems we face in this world, climate change being one, and leverage these systems to help us find new and novel solutions. So I'm overall really excited. And make no mistake, there's a lot going wrong in the field of AI in terms of biases, for example, which get perpetuated by these systems. But that aside, overall, I'm very positive.
Well, thanks for that intro, Pascal. It seems like you've been around the space for a while. So I mean, I really appreciate you joining us today and providing your perspective. I think you and I certainly have probably been following this field for a while. And it's sort of, I guess there's an expectation that the tech is not actually that new. We've just sort of crossed a bit of a threshold. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that the fervor is about sort of crossing a threshold around acceptance in sort of a broader culture and people starting to use it in ways that maybe were unintended. So I'm starting to see some like weird sort of ripple effects out there. How would you sort of recommend that our audience or sort of leadership teams today deal with that sort of new speed, deal with that sort of advanced technologies, not just AI, but sort of getting out there with speed, disrupting in ways that we could not intend? How do you suggest that they sort of get ahead of some of the weird uses and the sort of the pace of change that we're facing today?
Yeah, James, I think the step change, and you and I having been in this space for quite a while, I think really the step change for me is the fact that when ChatGPT launched, you suddenly had a interface which looks familiar, which is a text box, which just looks like the Google search engine, which allows you to interact with a very, very powerful language model, where you can start having conversation, which in some ways really feels like the good old Turing test, right? The point where you can't actually distinguish if you're talking to a machine or a human. Now, also these systems have their issues with hallucinations, for example, making up stuff, etc. But to your question of like, what do I actually recommend for people to do today? I really fundamentally believe that for people who are not as familiar with this as you, for example, who have been in this field for a long time and you really understand the nuances and what these systems can and can't do, etc., is really get your feet wet. It is still baffling to me when I speak to executives, for example, and I ask them, so who has used ChatGPT? I think by now, pretty much everybody has at least typed something into ChatGPT or a different system. Just make no mistake, there's many other systems out there from other vendors. So we're not favoring OpenAI here. But that being said, what I find really interesting is very few people actually have paid for GPT-4, which is the much more powerful language version, which has really fascinating features around, say, for example, plugins, or recently they launched something called Code Inspector, which we should talk about, which is mind-blowingly amazing. And the other thing which people tend to not do is a lot of people use it a little bit like they use Google. They ask it one question, they look at the answer, and they say, okay, that's it. And then they move on. When really the power of these systems is that you can have, because they have memory of your last questions, you can actually have conversation with them where you can say, summarize the following article. Now tell me what are interesting questions I should ask about this article. Tell me where the author might be wrong. Tell me all kinds of things. And I think for me, it really is about, because this is a new game. This is a little bit like we used to play tennis, which is a game which is played with a racket and a ball on a court. And now that game suddenly has become cricket. Still a racket, still a ball, still a court, different rules, different muscle memory. So for me, it's really about getting out there and starting to get your hands a little dirty to really understand how these systems even work and what their limitations are too.
So brilliant. And I love the way that you have just kind of synthesized this down into something that's relatable to everyone, right? So the two of you, right, have had tremendous experience with these and other technologies, and you've watched the evolution. But many, to your point, their relationship with technology is, in fact, Google. So it's important to kind of demystify and kind of boil this down into frames that are accessible to everyone, because this will potentially change everyone's lives, mm-hmm. either directly and or indirectly. So if we think about how and why and to what degree this is changing the game, maybe if we step back and look at the past kind of few decades, what are some of the more systemic and problematic issues that this new game that AI is actually solving? Why the fervor and the push to AI? I mean, It may seem very intuitive to everybody, but what are the more systemic issues that AI is solving for humanity, and what could be problematic if we don't design it in a way that opens up the right pathways, right? So what is the problem landscape behind us, and what is the potential problem landscape in front of us?
I would love to hear James's perspective here, because James, you're working on this. You're actually bringing it into places like NASA. I'd be curious to hear, before I babble on the stuff I'm seeing, I'd just be really curious to hear, what are the problem fields you are actually deploying AI in unique ways, which were probably not solvable beforehand, or not as well solvable?
Well, I think you sort of touched on some of this work initially, is that because the interface has sort of been simplistic, I think people have sort of gotten into it in a way that feels normal. So they're having conversations, they're having chat, which is really exciting. But I think that most people in their sort of chats from texting mom, I'm not asking her sort of deep theoretical questions on background about our topic. I might be looking for a specific answer. So I think that even interface and medium is maybe almost biasing the role and sort of our usage. So I do think that I see GPT and sort of other large language models becoming sort of research assistants. And once that this gets in the hands of people who cannot, the physical limitations of humans, and I think this is the great work that NASA and Convergent Aeronautics Solutions is working on, that we've been sort of championing in our team, is we're trying to solve world scale problems that are by definition complex and hard to understand. So if we can have a computer help us understand that faster and quicker, if it can read 1,000 articles for every 2 that we get through, we can actually synthesize a lot of findings and then target our work and our focus on the space that is most impactful. So I do see that as sort of a growing space. On the flip side, I am worried about sort of the impact of the sort of the chat interfaces in the future. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine the Facebooks or the WhatsApps or all these sort of, or even X.com or whatever it is now, all these interfaces that we know historically in the last decade have really shaped policy and politics around the world for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. My biggest fear, the thing that keeps me up at night, is imagine trying to have a political discourse that you think is genuine online for someone who's not tech-enabled and cannot smell an AI, but 9 out of the 10 people you interact with online are bots. Mm-hmm. You will never win an argument with them, and you will feel the pressure of the crowd, the psychological pressure of the crowd, saying, well, I'm the last one standing. I guess I should just conform. And like that to me is terrifying, but we are not 20 years out from that. We are 2 years out from that. So those are the things that sort of keep my mind up. But yeah, I want to hear what your thoughts are, because you again, there's so many potential problems. I'm sure you are seeing some different things.
Yeah, I love the way you frame this, and 100% agree with the challenge around, for example, disinformation, particularly exponentially accelerated disinformation. As you mentioned, like there might be 9 voices crowding out 1 voice of reason, for example. Really thinking about the use case positive side, what is unique, as Diane asked in the first part of her question. So really what stands out for me is that we have these systems which are trained on an incredibly large body of language and allow us to do analysis on rather unstructured bodies of data. And I think that's a really fascinating insight for me, which is we couldn't do that before. Like we could crunch large amounts of data in databases, in Excel spreadsheets, etc. But it had to be in a particular format, had to be clean data. And even in the field of AI, and James, I'm sure you went through that pain as well, until recently, we needed labeled data, right? So like one of the big challenges was like, oh my God, we need to like now employ people to label data, to say what you see here is a picture of a hot dog and this is a cat. And so we know that next time we see a hot dog or a cat, like we can actually distinguish between those two things. And what generative AI does to a large extent is it gets rid of that. And a good example for me is ChatGPT's code interpreter, which is a really fascinating piece of technology, which allows you to upload a data set, CSV, Excel, etc., up to 100 megabytes, which is a decent amount of data. It crunches this data. It allows you to ask natural language questions about this data, so to visualize it, to find correlations, etc. And what it does in the background, which is really fascinating, is they generate Python code, so computer code, to run against this data to get to actual results, so like validated results. And I do believe, and this is where I think the power comes from, because these systems have the ability to ingest enormous amounts of information, it allows us to find correlations. And if you think about innovation, innovation is typically not inventing something completely new. That is actually exceedingly rare. What innovation typically is the combination, the recombination of existing things in new and novel ways. And I believe that if we're starting to use AI in interesting new ways, we can actually accelerate this and thus tackle some of the world's biggest problems. Now with that, and this is where, James, I want to build on what you just said in terms of like what keeps me up at night, the very simple fact that if you take a system like GPT-4, which has allegedly nobody really knows because it's a black box, which in itself is another problem, but has allegedly a trillion tokens, so a trillion kind of like connections between itself, being trained on essentially all the text which is available on the internet. Now, if you think about who generated that text on the internet, it is predominantly white male Western audiences. So these systems inherently have a bias based on their training data. And that is, I think, is really complicated because it underrepresents minorities, it underrepresents specific parts of the world, like the global south, etc. So that becomes a real issue, which I think we need to address and tackle. Now, where I get pretty optimistic is the other rumor which is spreading through the internet is that it cost OpenAI $63 million to train GPT-4. Which sounds a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, it's actually not that much money. And if that is true, and assuming that these costs come down too, because exponential technologies, I believe that we should fund work for minorities, smaller ethnic groups, etc., to train these models on bodies of text, on bodies of information, which hopefully eliminates some of that biases.
I'd like to build on that. So you sort of tapped in on this persistent bias issue. So one of the things I recently read as a paper, I think in pre-published state right now, about the limits of AI and particularly generative AI when it's trained on its own outputs. Basically, that AI starts to degrade pretty quickly, falls off a cliff in its quality when it starts to train on data that it generated. And I sort of imagine this is like my example has been sort of like AI prion disease. Mad cow disease is because cows consuming matter, like meat matter of cows. Prion disease is if you eat the flesh of your species, you get weird proteins in the brain, everything goes sideways. Same issue with AI. But if AI starts to be used to generate all this SEO text, it starts to be used in social media, we've basically sort of salted the earth of new text. So not only will everything after 2023 be sort of suspect and probably unusable from training new data, that means that all the bias that you just mentioned will be persistent because like that's the last bit of human information that we had. So we will never get to a state where sort of the white male perspective isn't the majority voice because that will be the sort of the last set of clean data we had to train on. And that to me is sort of terrifying that 2023 is the last year where we'll sort of be able to trust data from a sort of a training model perspective. And again, we don't know. That paper is brand new. We are just sort of exploring this. So I think even the AI experts are trying to figure out where this goes. So yeah.
Fantastic and terrifying. So
yes.
The watchwords of the year, fantastic and terrifying.
but we have to anticipate these utopian and dystopian potential eventualities in order to take action now to prune the bad branches and try to move this in towards a path of goodness. So I think this represents a potentially exciting renaissance moment for humanity. But with that comes a tremendous responsibility to be vigilant and proactive and move this together in the most informed possible way towards a path of goodness. So I love this conversation and I guess that is my key takeaway, right? That we need to be aware now and to take action now in order to make sure that this doesn't get away from us and we aren't stumbling towards kind of the path of unintended consequences of this incredible new capability. So that's my takeaway, James. Your thoughts as we kind of wrap up this stage of the discussion?
Yeah, I think Pascal's examples were pretty telling and sort of that we don't know what we don't know, and even the experts are still, I think, figuring this out. And that was sort of my key takeaway. And that is, again, terrifying and fantastic and terrifying. So if we are not sort of watchful for that, if we are not sort of thinking about that, we will make missteps. But we can put that foresight, we can put that sort of thought into it up front and hopefully avoid some of this. So
yeah,
there is good news.
Yeah, absolutely. And in our next episode, we will be looking forward. We'll be kind of opening up the discussion of the what if and what's possible and what are those unimpossible futures that this could potentially unlock. So Pascal, as we kind of wrap up this discussion, any final thoughts for our listeners and regarding why we're here, what's gotten us here, what the watchouts and the kind of the problem landscape that this capability, this exciting new capability unlocks for us?
Yeah, I think just building on what James said, I believe the interesting thing is that because this is so new and really nobody knows anything ultimately, I just want to point out that truly the future is unwritten in this space. And that is terrifying. And at the same time, I think it's an incredible invitation for us to create the future we want. So my call to arms is that we need to get everybody involved. We need not just people like James and myself, the technologists, to be involved. We need everybody to be involved in this and shape it in the way we actually want. And then I think we have a good shot at creating something which is truly incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Pascal, for joining us today and helping us explore this incredible problem and opportunity landscape and the shift towards AI, some of the early impacts for society, industry, and the economy. So for our listeners, please do be sure to check out the next two podcast episodes as we continue the conversation with Pascal on AI, the opportunity, its limitations, and designing for ecosystemic resilience within our economy. Follow us on Apple Podcasts and all your favorite places to access podcasts. And you can learn more always at socialworks.com. Thanks, everyone.